Accession number 23218, Reel 7.
Colonel Goodman saith, Reel 7. You described the Christmas dinner that you had rearranged in Holland in the winter of 1944. Yeah. What happened after that?
First of all, I will tell you a short thing about this Christmas dinner, which was supposed to be one of the highlights of that time of the year, of course. And we had just sat down after all the trouble we had.
Carry on. Yeah.
All the trouble we had to get out there, because you know the reason behind all this was the Rundstedt offensive, which had to led to regrouping all over the place. So we knew that we would have to do some patrolling on the Maas. To check on what the Germans were thinking of doing, or if they were coming with any troops that way. But during that dinner, of course, the captain of the troop commander, when all was assembled, minus one patrol who had to be sent out the same night, and he got up and he was wishing us all the best and having a merry Christmas dinner. And here we have, he said, the pork. We can take as a gift from the Dutch people. The aquavit is from the Norwegian government, and we had then also got a small packet each from the Norwegian Red Cross in London, and the red and that we can sort of think it is a package from home. And as he said that, a big bang, and this was in the drawing hall of a school, with window all on three walls were just only open, great big windows. And then we too had landed just outside this school.
Did it do a lot of damage?
No, it landed on the out in the field, but all the windows where we were sitting were blown out, and the glass came in all over the place. And you know, the food was in this. In the tins, you know, where we had it. We were also in our boxes we had our dinner in, you know.
Yeah, and mess tins.
Yeah, mess tins. Mm-hmm. And of course, they were full of glass bits. And we had never had, for a long, long time, not have any sort of fresh meat, only army coop, only army rations, you know. And digging out and try to find out all the glasses before we swallowed the meat and the potatoes and on. But we had aquavit in our mugs, and we swallowed it down with aquavit, and we thought that if it made any difficulties in the stomach, we could take that on later.
Did anyone suffer from any sort of injury?
One had the stomach trouble after that, but it was not very much though. But we started patrolling the same night along the Maas, and we went on patrol two or three times a week. The main reason was, of course, Maas was now the northern border of the 21st Army Group. And they were the danger which were coming when the Germans started building up on that front, because that had been fairly quiet for a while. And what we found was in the Maas, there was an island called Kapelche there. And we found that after a short time that there were some activity from the Germans on that Kapelche there. So we concentrated on that place, and we, after a while, we looked them over every two times at least, once each week, and we could see they were building up something.
What sort of things did you observe then?
We saw them digging and making strongholds. For they had workers there during the day who was making, not pillboxes, but some preparations to build out positions.
What was this island like? What size was it? And
was a long, long island. I would say it was about 2 miles long. And it was covered by dikes on all the side. In the middle of the island was a big dike about 4 meters high all over the island from east to west. And then small dikes going from that one out to the river. There were two rivers on both sides then, of course. So after we had reported back, we found out after about a week's time, I think, yes, that this was a SS battalion making a stronghold. And that, of course, was found by the staff behind us, that this is a build-up for an attack, which they're probably going to do. And we got then the message back that we should attack and capture this and destroy this position out there. And we had about a couple of days discussion with 47 Royal Marines and ourselves. And we were going to do the main attack, but we were going to get supported from both sides from 47 Royal Marines.
On the island, you mentioned that they had dikes and so forth.
Yeah.
Were there any elevations on the island, or was it a flat?
It was very flat island. Very flat. Only the elevation, the high ground was only the dikes.
What about the vegetation? Were there trees on the island? Or
no.
It was open?
Open, yeah. Mm. Yeah. No trees.
Were there any buildings on it?
No, there was only a small building and a sort of a quay on the place that they come over. But there was no permanent building in that part where we were patrolling. Mm. So the attack was going to be set in launched on the night of 13th to 14th January 1945. The Poles build a small walking bridge across our side of the Polish Armored Division, which was there, and we started off just before midnight. And we then moved with two platoon. We were only two, of course. We were only platoon. I had the left platoon along the riverbank, on our side of the riverbank, and the other number one platoon moved along the dike. And our plan was to, first of all, to come down to a front, to a cross dike, which was leading right down to whatever building there
was. Was this going to be a silent attack?
That we thought.
That was the plan?
Yeah, that was
so
the plan.
So you were going to creep up on them when they were asleep?
Yeah, no, we were looking forward also, just waiting for the 47 to come up and give us the signal that they were ready, and then we were going to do a big attack. We were then use the whole number five troop in one big attack. Moving along this center big dike, we had to set, of course, over the other side to control when we moved along. And we had only just put them over the top, then both were killed.
How were they killed?
By Germans.
Was this by fire?
By fire, yeah, yeah. Shot, yeah. Mm. Rifle fire, of course, we have two single shots. So that, of course, disturbed our plan quite heavily. But we moved on, and I, of course, moved along the riverside and go up to this cross dike, which was very low, only a couple of meters high. It was, I think, about 2 meters high. And we started to... I let my platoon lay the sea cover as far as I could there, so we had the other platoon commander, I had a discussion. And we had seen nothing to 47 Royal Marine. And we sent our normal signals over by radio, and we didn't get an answer back. While we were doing this and discussing this, then we were attacked. For the Germans, they were on the other side of the dike, both the little dike and the other dike side.
So you were in the corner, the little dike and the big dike.
Yeah. And they all...
They were on either side.
Yeah.
Yes.
And they had dug in on their side of the dike. So we had to get in action. And we first of all, we threw them back the first attack. And then we said, okay, now we used the result of this attack, throwing them back. So we started an attack by ourselves, not waiting for 47. And we got only about, 50 yards. Then there was a hail of fire coming from all these prepared positions and so on. I think they knew in some way that we were coming. They had probably seen the Polish making this short bridge over us and so on. So we were thrown back, and at the same time as we were thrown back, we were claiming our heavy fire from mortars and artillery.
Was that your side or their side?
No, their side.
Their side.
They covered our... their artillery and mortar fire came from them.
So you were in their defensive fire zone?
Yeah. And the only way I had to survive with my platoon, we went into the river. We stood in the river more or less... Yeah, 2 or 3 hours at least, on and off, little bit on land and then down. And the river was freezing because there was ice flakes running down the river. So then we said that we have to try another attack, and then my platoon and the number one platoon, which up in the big corner by the two dikes, we thought that we will try... Together, both of us, one giving fire, another moving forward, and then when we reach a certain amount of places you can see in front, then we're going to do the other way around.
How much could you see?
It was pitch dark. It was in November, remember that?
In the middle of the night?
Yeah. We started, when this second attack got in, it was about, I would say, about 3 o'clock. And we just got up, and as we got over the ridge of the dunes. The same hailstorm of fire was at us. So we had nothing more to do than to try to find cover some place or another. And by this time we had so many casualties, so many wounded, that there were nearly no one left. So we counted out, we had altogether with three officers, 22 was the whole group was there, out of the 92.
How many so you had 92 at the beginning of the attack?
Yeah, 72 at the beginning of the attack, sorry. Yeah. So, and then when we started to figure out what we were going to do, we were 22 altogether. And we had had four killed, and it was so started the march for where we got over the river and down to up to the fighting area was about a mile, I would say. Yeah. And so it took a long time for those stretcher bearers to get them back. And then, of course, they had to be away, and some didn't come forward either. So we had the headquarters on the other side, so we asked them what to do, and we gave them the situation. We were 22 left, and it seems to be difficult or impossible to move forward. Then they told us that assemble what troops you have and try a last attack.
So you want to go into the attack for a third time?
Yeah. And then, of course, Captain Haugevold, he was okay that time, so he said, okay, he talked to, pointed to me and said, you take the 22 men and you try. And we assembled them and got hold of all the Bren guns we could have. They were not spread around because the wounded had left them and so on. And we were ready to move straight on as far as we could, putting all the Bren guns to give supporting fire. And I was just on the way to say, go. Then there came a notice, there came a word on the radio, cut out, retreat. And when we were getting ready to retreat, there was no possibility to start with before they already been given orders to the Polish armor division. And they had moved forward 12 tanks, which was lining up on our side of the border there, and they gave us supporting fire to bring us out of this area.
How did you get out then? Did you go back?
We went back to the places we crossed the river in the same way as we moved forward in an attack. With patrol before and more or less running 100 meters and so on and taking cover and that. So it took us about an hour to get back.
Were you under fire all the way back?
No, only the first half of the way back, and then it stopped. So they didn't dare to come further on. And 2 weeks later, the Canadians attacked the same island, and they had 374 killed. Think of that. But then, of course, they had reinforced it, of course, so it was a much tougher defense organization at that time.
When you were making your attack, did you have any idea of how many machine guns the Germans had in the area?
No. That I think, if I am honest, no, I would say that that actually was our own fault. We should have, of course, make a reconnaissance and getting much more details of their position and their running. Our thought was that this was early in the build-up phase, so if we can stop them now, then we will have not have to face the same possibilities and something later if they were able to build it up properly.
It was really a spoiling attack, which you were trying to do.
Yeah.
Did the Germans attempt to use the island as a base for attacks?
No, the Canadians got them out.
The Canadians got them out?
Yeah. And they used two battalions.
So a two battalion attack. Was that strongly supported, the Canadian attack? Do you know?
We were told that they had a heavy artillery bombardment before they went in. We had nothing like that, because it's more or less going to be a surprise attack.
What had happened to 47th Commander, who was supposed to be giving you fire support? Did you find out?
No, it had been a discussion on there, and of course in this joint conference, I was not with that, between our boss and 47, they didn't quite agree on the same, what they were going to do. So 47, they had quite a hard beating just about for a week or 4 months before this. So they were accepted only reluctantly that they were going to give fire support. So why they were not forward, I don't know, but they came in later on, but then we were gone.
Sounds as though there's a misunderstanding about agreed.
Must have been, because we fought together with 47 also on Valkyrie.
Yes.
So it was Colonel Phillips, I think. So we knew them quite well, too. So that was... Well, that was the last man-to-man fighting we experienced on the continent.
What happened to you then when you got back from this operation? And how many of you came back? You said you had 22 men left when you were...
And that attack, we had 4 killed and 21 wounded out of 72. So, of course, after that, the strange thing was that this attack was put in on the night... 13th to 14th January 1945. On the 10th of January, one officer from and 20 men had arrived from Scotland as reinforcements. And of course, we couldn't take them with us. They had not been with us, not been training, and we didn't actually know who they were. But they had one officer, Lieutenant Gabriel Smith, and he begged, and he was allowed to come with us. And he was killed.
That was bad luck.
Yeah.
Was that his first operation?
Yeah, but he lost his nerve. After the first attack, when we were thrown back, he was just waiting behind this first thing. Then when we got back, that bit downhearted, of course, then he raced up alone and ran forward and said, "Come and see our house, Sveinunde." That was what he was yelling. Mm. And then, of course, he had it on that. So...
Sounds like a tragedy.
Yeah, it was.
So you got back across the bridge the Poles had built.
Yeah. And the Poles transported us back to our village there, to our school where we were living. And we had also to, after that, we were told to patrol for another 14 days, only one patrol a week. And that was to keep control on what was happening there and report that back. So they had to keep under observation before they were going to attack it again with the Canadians.
Were any of these patrols eventful? Did you have any meetings with the enemy?
No. It was only reconnaissance patrols. Mm. So we avoided any meetings, of course. So then we lived up at the Osterhout. It was the place where we had our base there, up at the Maas. And another week, after another week, we got orders to move back to Valkere. Oh, and we put up our bases in Vlissingen in Valkeren, and was only to be there in case to keep Germans from moving down to Valkeren Island, because North Beveland was not captured. They didn't bother any to do anything with it. And then after the end of February, we were all transported back to Eastbourne, our base. And there our king invited the whole troop to a welcome dinner, or a thanking dinner. So. And there was General Sturgis. He was then at that time seen in the command operation. And the king and our army commander was there. And we were just waiting then in Eastbourne. And then we got another surprise. In the end of May, we all got £20 and extra clothing coupons and told to go and buy ourselves civilian clothes.
Were you given an explanation of why you were doing that?
Yeah, not in the beginning, but then after, you know, what we did actually, we didn't buy much civilian clothes. Mm. We bought a jacket, and then we used the rest, of course, for trousers and everything, shirts, but we used what we had. And then we were divided up in group of 20s, transported up to Norfolk, and flown by the American Air Force to Stockholm in Sweden. And that has been a mystery since later on. I've asked people, or some others, and also from the Norwegian Army Command and Norwegian Defense leaders and so on, what was the reason for bringing us to Sweden? Was it to, they thought of that time that all Norwegian troops in Sweden could be used in invasion in Norway. And in Norway there was 380,000 German soldiers. 380,000.
And how many Norwegian troops were there in Sweden?
Oh, there were no troops whatsoever. There were sort of, I would say about police company, but that was what they were called. There were around about 20,000, I would say, altogether. And then we were going to have some war experience with this unit if they had to go in. And later I heard another thing that was General Eisenhower as CNC, all Central European operations. He had contacted with the Swedes and asked the Swedes to be ready to help to move in if it came to fighting in Norway. And I've been told that we were going then to join the Swedish groups. Yeah. But we never got that.
What happened then when you got to Stockholm? What did they do with you when you arrived?
Nothing. The only thing was that we landed at about 5 in the morning, 4 in the morning at Bromma airfield in Stockholm. And the custom people were a little bit surprised too. There was no Norwegian liaison to meet us. And when they opened my suitcase, another from our officer, the first thing they saw was the commander uniform on the top of our suitcase. And I just closed it very closely and let us move in. So I was the first group who came over with 20 men, about 2 officers and now 18. And we requisitioned place on the Grand Hotel in Stockholm. It couldn't be better. And the troops, they lived in another hotel quite close by. So, the people from the German delegation in Stockholm, they lived also in the same hotel.
So you were rubbing shoulders with the enemy?
Yeah, but then we were in civilian clothes. Mm. And then came 7th of May. That was the capitulation. And then they looked at us as some dirt in their places, you know. We probably didn't look sort of very nice either, but then we called the service and told them to press our uniforms, and then we got down in the hotel lobby and saloons, 5 of us in uniforms, and then of course at that time we owned the whole hotel. Yeah. So that was something else. But that was the end of the war from number 10 Commando, or the 5th Norwegian Troop then.
So you said there were five of your officers. How many men had you got with you when you went off to Sweden?
I think we were about 60, 65. Quite wounded. Some of them got out of the hospital very quickly, but some had to be there for the rest of the summer, at least, before they got home. Yeah. So.
Did you have warning that the capitulation was going to take place?
Yeah.
How did you hear about that?
That was all over the world. That was official, you know, that in all the papers. And in Sweden, of course, there was no censorship whatsoever. So we got that very, very clearly. And we were not, at that time at least, especially fond of the Swedes because of what they have done with letting the troops go through up to Narvik and so on. But we managed and we got home.
What about your connections back home? You said there was no one there to meet you when you arrived at the airfield. How did you establish contact with
Of course, there was a Norwegian military attache and there was a Norwegian organization in Stockholm, of course. The legation, what it was called at that time, was fairly big. And when they woke up, they tried to cover over this and did all what they could. That we found ourselves at home in Stockholm, of course. But we just walked about and waited for the time I could go back. And you know, Norway capitulated on the 7th of May, or 8th of May, probably is the right day. And the 9th, we went by train from Stockholm to Oslo.
What happened when you got to Oslo and come back?
We landed on the sidetrack down by the harbour. There was no one to meet us. Absolutely no one. So we just assembled and got our pack out and ordered some transportation to bring it down to Akershus Festning. So we marched down and stopped outside. At that time was the army headquarters, headquarters of the Norwegian army. And first of all, asked them to make a decision, where were we going to live, what were we going to do. And that took some time. We got place in the barrack, in the one of the engineering school and at Akershus Festning, or fortress. But we stayed there for only 2 nights, and then we organized ourselves billets up in the town.
What were you supposed to be doing? What were your orders when you went to Oslo on the train?
We were just going to report for the Norwegian Army headquarters.
Go to the Festning and report to headquarters.
Yeah. And say, here we are, here we are. Mm. So this was this undefinite or undecided time went the rest of May. But then the King's Guard was going to reorganize in the first week of June. And so I and one of officer called one from second in command in one platoon, and 20 men from five troop was attached to the guard, the King's Guard, to organize it from the start. I was then the adjutant of the King's Guard, and Skutle became company commander. And I was in the King's Guards for 1 year, and Skutle, he was there till he went off. Was pension off, because he had no regular officer education, and he was then just called in or accepted as he was.
Where did you get the men from the new King's Guard?
I had to do that as adjutant from the King's Guard. I put an advertising in all the Norwegian papers from Trøndelag, that's north of Trondheim, and all down south, and asked former guardsmen to report to service. They were given 3 months extra service and then had to report on them. We put them into uniforms and started off the King's Guard. Quite a lot of the former officers and so on from the King's Guard also reported. But there was a snag with that. Because, you know, we had a lot of people around the country which has been playing with not with us or our side, but with the enemy side. And they thought...